During the preparation of this talk, reading the title of the subsequent talk of Bahareh Sharifi and Reina Onat, I wondered if what I'm doing were not in a way what Audre Lorde's quote criticizes of their title. If I were not using the master's tools and thus being unable to dismantle the master's house. I'm going to talk about the European canon of masterworks, which up to our days is a centerpiece of the education of higher music schools. I'm going to talk about the German-Austrian canon of music with the works of the so-called Viennese classics, which became a sort of epitome of music in the course of the 19th century, and that is when the higher education in music was institutionalized in most European countries and became a paradigm for it worldwide. Are we going to talk about the construction of this canon and the notions and discourses that enabled this construction, the idea of musical progress, and thus also of modernism versus tradition, of art music versus all other kinds of music, the notion of and becoming of a universal term of music which supported the idea of a universal evolutionary history. And I'm going to talk about the structures, the discursive as well as institutional ones, sustaining all these notions up to our days. And I want to call this ensemble of notions, discourses, institutional structures, and so on, a dispositif, using the term of Michel Foucault for an extended form of discourse, including institutional, physical, symbolical, iconographical, and also acoustical and more issues in creating disciplines and notion of what art is and so on. So my perspectives will be from this side of the European order, or better, disorder. Taking in this perspective and trying to analyze the construction and operating of this canon, I cannot avoid talking about the canon itself. Moreover, I do not hate this canon of German-Austrian music. On the contrary, I'm involved. And I thus want to start with a little personal story, because I grew up with this canon, and I did so by personal choice, because as a little child, I deep-heartedly wanted to play the violin. And against the skepticism of my mother, and although I did not grow up in the typical family of middle-class intellectuals, I finally did. I had this choice, however, and it was certainly a privilege. I was privileged. Playing the violin, even in the 1970s, when I was a teenie, was not mainstream, however, and not at all cool. I had to defend it in front of myself, not only against diverse fashions, which seemed much cooler, but also politically in a way. Rock music had been a protest against the bourgeois establishment from the beginning, and diverse popular black folk music were part of the social and civil rights movement still in the 1970s. This music was obviously politically much correcter than bourgeois European classical music. Anyway, by the age of 16, I played the double concerto for two violins together with my best friend, a girl of 16 like me, and although I didn't know it, my first love. And I will play you the beginning of the second movement just to give you an impression what it might mean for two high voices being in love with each other to play this concerto.
Thank you.
Okay. We played the concerto in many places, in churches, at school, but the most beloved place to play it was outside in the forest at a little river, Bach in German. We were laughing at each other playing Bach at the Bach. Many years later, after having been to Latin America, the place where I thought the revolution might take place when I was 16, after having studied music pedagogy at a European art university similar to this one, after having been fighting for the alteration of the music curricula for the visibility of women in music for women composers, many years after having written my PhD in musicology, the concerto came back to me. I encountered it at a conference where I gave a talk. Bach, genius, genus, generations. Bach, genius, genus, generationen, was the title of the conference, which was supposed to bring together Bach scholarship and musicological gender studies. Listening to the concerto again, after probably more than 20 years, live, of course, because it was a huge conference of the Bach Society, and they had really great musicians to play this music, felt like coming home. But the home was ruined. And in a way, I invite the colleagues from the Leipzig Bach Institute for the absolutely unfractured relationship to this home. For them, it had stayed safe all the time. And remembering Nana's very thoughtful and inspiring talk yesterday, I think losing home is part of what becomes uncomfortable if we think of the colonial disorder in terms of an entangled history. Anyway, thanks to Bach's care and proud of their musical family members, I can show you an illustration of that home, which is part of this title, Bach Genus Generations. It's the Bach family tree. For the first time, made by one of the sons of Jean-Sebastian Bach. And what you see on this slide, and what in this case really was a family tree, became an icon of music history up to our days. I'm sure some of you will know these posters from school. You might even find an exemplar somewhere here in this house. A diversification seems to have taken place, however. Beneath the family tree of Western art music, featuring the masters of European classical music, you will find the family tree of rock and pop music, or of American jazz, and so on. But three underlying ideas remain consistent in all these illustrations. Remain consistent in all these illustrations. There are three features. And I first talk about the first two ones. Firstly, time is being visualized, which means that it is spatialized. It is perceived from a privileged perspective and is at a single glance. It becomes, so to call, panoptical. Secondly, history is being naturalized. Visualizing it as a family tree means framing music history as a biological process and at the same time as an evolutionary progress. And regarding the third feature, I ask you for patience. I will mention this in a minute. Spatializing time has been analyzed by postcolonial scholars as a very effective instrument of power having been established during European Enlightenment. It has been used to create an unbridgeable gap between Europeans and the people outside European civilization, raw or wild people in the terms of the 18th century, primitive people in terms of the late 19th and beginning of the 20th century. The notion that so-called raw or wild people represent a former stage of universalist evolution catapulted Africans, American natives, and diverse other people out of contemporaneousness into another time. Anna has mentioned that also yesterday. And, nota bene, family tree, as they were supposed to be the childhood of humankind, simultaneously it legitimized the self-authorization of Europeans to educate them. The whole impertinence and mendacity of this paternal attitude becomes very clear at the end of the 19th century in connection with colonial spectacles. The exhibition of humans from the colonies in zoos and in circuses or theaters, during world exhibitions, or, to remain within the German context, during the Berlin so-called Congo Conference in 1884 and 85, where Africa was partitioned among the European imperialist states. These spectacles were the reverse side of the spatialization of time in the family tree. They created anachronistic spaces in the middle of European metropolis. And in case you think I've lost my thread and I'm not talking about music or higher education of arts anymore, modern academic musicology was not at all untouched by these spectacles. On the contrary, part of these spectacles were musical performances which provided source material for the beginning of the so-called comparative musicology, the beginning of the 20th century, the precedent of today's ethnomusicology or anthropology of music. Founded by natural scientists and psychologists like Erich Moritz von Hornbostel, Karl von Stumpf, and Otto Abraham, and relying on new technical devices of phonography and of the possibility of sound recording, this new branch challenged the young academic musicology, specifically the historical branch and its methods of historical hermeneutics based on written sources. And although I cannot deepen this, it's no exaggeration to say that modern academic musicology, not only its disciplinary order, but also historical musicology as such. And this is one base of also the canon, which is up to nowadays taught in the historical branch of if you're studying instruments. Not only its disciplinary order, but also historical musicology as such has been shaped by colonial discourses. The creation of anachronistic spaces within the panoptical order of biological frame progress, however, was one of the most effective technologies of power of European imperialism at the end of the 19th century, displacing people from the colonies, as well as people from the lower classes in the centers of colonialism, into anachronistic spaces was a means to deny their contribution to progress. But spatialization of time as well as the creation of anachronistic spaces include crucial paradoxes. Whereas the colonial spectacle for the spectator sort of created a testimony of European modernity and progress, it was able to see that that was a difference. It was at the same time contested by it because it made vanish the time difference between the European spectator and his exhibited others. Same is true with the family tree of naturalized progress. The gap which is created between the Europeans and their others was steadfastly questioned because the notion that the latter represent a former state of their own selves linked both inseparably. And as literary scholar Anne McClintock has shown, this paradox is mediated by the category of gender. The family trees of progress and human evolution get along without women. And this is the third feature of this visualization of time in the family tree, which we can see up to our days. Thus, women are the participation of women in progress is denied, and at the same time, this gendered paradox sort of balances the inner contradiction of the icon itself. And this, as I just said, is a third feature with all the family trees. And I'm sorry, I think the picture is not very well, but all these names of the Bach family tree you see are male names. And this is somewhat striking because this was made as was thought in the beginning as a real family tree, as a tree of the family, of the musical family Bach. But even more striking is the fact that this feature has even been transported into the German Music Encyclopedia, MGG, Die Musik in Geschichte und Gegenwart, which in the entry, Bach family, provides a modern version of this family tree. And it's hard to find an explanation for this fact, be it regarding the historical Bach family tree or the modern one. The argument that the historical family tree might only list up the official musicians of the family, who at the time of Jean-Sébastien Bach's ancestor were still organized in guilds, does not gain traction. Because here, also in the old family tree, the baronly singer of the court in Köthen, Bach's second wife, Anna Magdalena Bach, who was a professional musician, is lacking in the Bach family tree. And interestingly, the MGG, on the other hand, lists up all male members of the family, so all the non-musicians, but none of the female, But in the following list, there's following a list after the family tree in the MDG, the following list is headed due to the alphabetical order, by Anna Magdalena Bach, so the famous dedicatee of the Notenbüchlein. Anna Magdalena Bach, however, is not the worst example for the construction of anachronistic spaces in music history. As a singer, she represented the notion of natural and unmediated expressiveness, which in aesthetic treatises of the Enlightenment is closely connected with voice, body, and presence. And this is my focus and my main thesis in the following bit longer half of my talk. I will argue that in the course of the development of the modern notion of the European artwork, which took place in the second half of the 18th century, and which ended up in a universal notion of music with the Viennese classic as its prototype type, that development, so-called wild and raw people, as well as women, children, and mentally ill, served as threshold figures. They were closely connected with the essence of the notion of what art is or what it should be, and at the same time they marked its margins. And as threshold figures, they provided a somewhat eroticized path into the unknown land of musical expression, like mostly female monsters in the maps of the European conquerors of the Renaissance. To analyze this process, I will focus on the 18th century, but for the beginning, I will take up a little discussion which took place in the 1950s in German after-war musicology. In 1954, in a small book called Music and Language, the German-Greek musicologist Trasibulus Georgiadis called the characteristically new feature of Viennese classic as the way it captures acts, specifically human acts, als das Erfassen des Handelns, des spezifisch menschlichen Handelns. I will now have some slides with text, and most of this text is originally in German. And in my talk, I'm going to read the English translations, and I have the German text on the slides, and I hope this will work out, because sometimes it's really not very easy to translate it specifically than for the historical. It's good to have the German original to see the notions. Anyway, now back to Georgiadis. One year after Georgiadis said the specific of human classical music is the capturing of human act, Hans Heinrich Eggebrecht, one of the most influential German after-war musicologists and one of the most contested ones in the recent years due to his most probable participation in Hitler's extermination policy in Eastern Europe, takes up this idea in an article which up to today is quite often quoted when scholars are writing on the late 18th century's paradigm of expressivity. A focus of Eggebrecht's is, pointedly formulated, the development of a universal concept of music. After Eggebrecht, the formerly, up to the first third of the 18th century, predominant style characteristics lost their significance due to the pervasion by one predominant style. For the styles characterized by the locations and occasions of music, which were effective until 1730, like church style, chamber style, and theater style, the latter, theater style, is the one which penetrates all the others. And this is Eggebrecht's link to Georgiadis. For the national styles, shaped by specific characteristics, as some of you might know from Bach's French sonatas or the Italian concert, it was the German or mixed style which, after Eggebrecht, pervaded the others and became what was perceived as good style in music. It would be an important work to closely read and analyze the facets of Eggebrecht's nationalist argumentation. My focus, however, is a different one, but I hope it will become clear that this is closely connected with the phenomenon of nation-building in music in a wide understanding. My focus is the question how the rise of instrumental music, and that's what Viennese classics was identified with from the retrospect, the highest development of instrumental music, how this rise of instrumental music as a main paradigm of European art music was fostered by what it excluded, by voice, by movement, body, and ritual. To formulate it more pointedly, I want to examine how the kernel of absolute music is shaped by what it expels, speech, dance, and as well as occasions like religion, ritual, or anything else. Georgiades' dictum, the new feature of Janer's classic, was a capturing of music of human acting, will serve as a cognitive dissonance in my argument, as it declares the theatrical action and thus body and its movement as a specific feature of a music which by definition is declared to be autonomous, and therefore as non-functional music is located at the top of the hierarchy of art music. So it exactly describes such an inclusion of what is being excluded. Georgiades' first musical example to illustrate his idea, however, is a famous piece of music theater, Pergolesi's comic opera La Serva Padrona. Precisely its first scene, it begins very abruptly. The beginning of the aria of Uberto, who when he starts to sing, Uberto is the main male character of the opera, waiting for his chocolate to be served by his female servant Vespetta. I kind of deepen this, but as you can imagine, this is a very interesting piece for gender as well as for postcolonial analysis. So Uberto is waiting for his chocolate, and before I go on, I just play the music example.
Aspettare e non venire, stare a letto e non dormire, ben servire e non gradire.
Georgiades points at the fact that Pergolesi in this aria does not compose the affect, but the theatrical action. Umberto's waiting, aspettare, and then, when he continues, much too quickly with the words, e non vivire, which evokes the impression that we ourselves as listeners are involved in the music, experiences this action by ourselves, bodily, so to say. Georgiades then detects the same quality of discontinuity, that's what it is. Discontinuity in Joseph Haydn's early and also his later string quartets, where it causes, again, the effect that musical motifs seem to become anthropomorphic figures and we participate in their actions, and thus, again, are involved. And this has helped to follow the at that time, the string quartet at that time abstract instrumental music. It was an abstract kind of music, and this kind of narrative which is transported by this discontinuity helps to get it. Now I just want to play one more example to make clear how this is then working in instrumental music. From Beethoven's late string quartets, the cavatina from Opus 130. And now I have to go. No, sorry. That's it. To do it a bit differently. There you have voice. You heard the beginning. It is a great chant. But then there's an abrupt an interruption and something else happens, and that's what I'm going to talk about then.
Thank you.
think what Georgiadis is talking about is presence. And I think this is an extremely interesting example of presence, because I saw some of your faces. You get the impression that in this middle party of this quartet, music is sort of developing in front of our eyes. It's like a stumbling voice, which is improvised. It's not written down. Of course, if you look at the score, it's constructed. You know that Beethoven had all those sketches and so on. But the impression which makes it so impressive is this notion of absolute presence. And this is a crucial characteristic of this music, this notion of and which generates the notion of unmediated expressiveness and the feeling to be addressed by the music directly. Have to look where I am now. And I think this unmediated presence, which became a crucial feature of the modern aesthetic of the 18th century, of the late 18th century, and this is then already beginning of the 19th century late quartets, like an anachronistic timeless space itself, was gendered and racialized. And this becomes obvious with many treaties of enlightenment, and I will concentrate now on specifically the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, mainly his essay sur l'origine des langues, and Johann Gottfried Herder, which had a crucial impact on the development of this aesthetic of unmediated expressiveness. And then I come to the first words in my title, Mother Tones and Raw Gestures. And I start with the mother tones. Due to the notion of agitated speech... Due to the notion of agitated speech as a shared origin of language and music, in Herder's as well as in Rousseau's writing, woman, more exactly, the mother, was located at the origin of music. In his treatise, Caligone, where Herder creates a systematic order of the arts which is gendered via the differentiated areas of man and woman, he states that the mothers are the ones who contributed the most to the art of speaking. And the aspects of language he stresses to be of motherly origin are mainly the musical ones. And now I have this quote in German on the slide, and I'll read it in English. Of the mothers, we learn to speak. Hail us, we learned it from them. Their melodious tone, their pleasant talkativeness, the tireless speaking to, on, and forth, like addressing, encouraging, and going on speaking, of the female sex with the children carries a melody of speech into their mind and heart with accent and gesture, a rich source of the multiple beauty. A consequence of the notion that unmediated expressiveness is the essence of music is the predominance of melody before harmony, which Herder as well as Rousseau emphasize in their writings. Harmony, in their opinion, only strengthens convention and thus leads to an alienation of social or the original or natural, so to call, accent of the voice. Both Herder as well as Rousseau use the term mother tone in this context to describe the naturalness of the accent of human voice as a model for melody. In Herder's writings, mother tone is a frequent, not the most frequent, however, metaphor for what he opposites to acoustic noise. He makes up this opposite melody or the tone, the single tone, and acoustic noise. And harmony, for Herder, thus, is a mere acoustic phenomenon which can be examined by scientific means or by the means of new theory. But this examination will by no means lead to an understanding of the effect that the single tone has on the human soul. And now I go on with the quote I already started. Pupil of harmony, Herder exclaims, "What do you know with it? With all your knowledge," he means, "what do you know of the least bit of the innermost moment of a single tone, of the power of a single accent on the soul? Nothing. All you know is how many tones are combined to form a noise, wherein any single tone, so to say, dies away in the moment of its effect." The most frequent metaphor Herder uses to describe the single tone is, and its effect on the soul is error of silver, a term which fits to his idea that the single tone is able to invade the core of the soul. But in some cases, he uses the term mother tone. And these are the cases when he is creating an opposite of death and life to strengthen his argument, like in the passage just quoted. And I go on with this quote. "You know only from the dead opposite of which you cannot explain and maybe after some time not feel how much more effective every mother tone would be if he would be not stifled by the regular sound of harmony," which Herder calls Geräusch, "in its tender force. You do only know of dead regularity from which you can never dream of anything else, and then dead sequence of dead regularities. You only hear acoustic noise, not tone. You only imagine proportions because you do not feel the lust or the voluptuousness of the tone anymore." And in a way, so to say, the scholar of harmony becomes a necrophilic in this quote. He has this vivid mother stands for life and then the death of the scholar of harmony. In Rousseau's essay, the mother, usually a central figure of discourse in many of his texts, only appears once, namely in the passage centered on what he calls the degeneration of music. Like Herder, also Rousseau sees the reason for this degeneration in the conventionalization of melody through harmony. Because melody loses its unmediated expressiveness, in his opinion, it is bereft of its effectivity. And this is a kernel of what he then calls degeneration. This happens, as Rousseau so argues, mainly by a deception and usurpation which essentially consists of a substitution of the mother. And now I have here the quote in French, and I will just read a short passage of it in English, my translation, to explain what I just said. "As the process in which the harmonic, the order of scales, has usurpated the name of melody, one was not able to deny the traits of the mother in this new melody," Rousseau writes. And here the mother represents the notion of the unity of sound and sense, to say it in a Saussurean sense, the unity of significant and signifié, which by the substitution through the order of tones conventionalized by harmony has been forgotten. And I could open here a window now, which I won't do, this notion that the body writes by itself is part of the development which enabled scripture from the beginning of the 18th century to become a medium of an archive of European art music. It's a kind of a paradox, because that scripture was sort of vivicated by this idea of the motherly tone in the scripture. It became a new sort of quality. But this would be another talk. From the mother tones, thus voice, I will return to the body, the second aspect connotated with unmediated expressiveness. And for a moment, I will go back to Herder's sentences already quoted earlier, where he describes the mothers at the beginning of speech. "With accent and gesture, mit Akzent und Gebärde," Herder writes, "the mother plants the melody of speech into the mind and hearts." Also in Rousseau's writings, it is gesture which, together with voice, which founds the expressiveness of music and enables music, in his opinion, to speak by itself. A very important feature of the becoming of instrumental music in this sense of being the epitome of music. The mimesis of voice and gesture enabled music to speak, and also enabled language to be communicated. In Herder's writings, however, music's ability of communication is even more direct. Here it is not mimesis, but the process of resonance, which submits unmediated expressivity by making the body and nerves move. "Hence dance," he writes in his late treatise Caligone, "hence gesture conjoined with music. The ones who are not able to fight these movements caused by music are the raw or wild people. Strongly moved, the primitive man, He says, Naturmensch cannot abstain from it. He expresses what he hears by the traits of the face, by the vibrancy of the hand, via posture and bending. But there are non-civilized people also in the Middle European civilization, among them women who, after Herder, are specifically receptive for gestures and, now I quote, the mourning tones of the wild. These sounds, he writes, these gestures, those simple paths of melody, they affect children and the people of sensibility, of the senses, women. On people of delicate feeling, on ill people, lonely and melodic and melancholic, thousands of times more than even truth itself when its tender voice would sound from heaven. So these are affected specifically, they have, in his opinion, because they are not able to sort of, in this notion, they are not able to intellectually keep this down. As already mentioned, and as these latter quotes show, Herder's aesthetic is based on this idea of resonance and the idea that one body will agitate another one by reverberation. His writings can thus illustrate how closely the aesthetic ideas of this time were connected with the contemporarily anatomic discourses, namely with the discovery of the nerve system. The nerves were supposed to be similar to the chords of an instrument, which resonate by vibration. These anatomic studies were part of two crucial Enlightenment discourses. First of these discourses was the attempt to situate humans at the scala natura, and the second was a search for the connection for the search for the connection between body and soul. Both closely interlinked discourses dealt with the search for the origins which before had been explained by religion, the origin of humans and the origin of music acting in a wide range. And both discourses were central for the crucial dissonance of Enlightenment, the promise of equality of all humans on the one hand and the mechanisms of exclusion which were inaugurated by discourses of difference. And reading Herder's theory of resonance from this background and taking into account its significance for the construction of the modern artwork and the notion of expressiveness thus means being aware of the link between this idea of the artwork and the beginning of modern racism. But the most crucial to conclude, the most crucial effect becomes visible even if we stay within the aesthetic realm itself. No, the conclusion comes, but I'm almost done. Sorry. The beginning of modern, even if we stay within the aesthetic realm itself, the beginning of modern of the modern notion of the musical artwork based on the idea of this unmediated expressiveness was also the beginning of a commodification of music. One might even guess, if not the visualization of music, which is part of this process, as you see those anthropomorph figures in your inner pictures, in your imagination, if this process is not even part of this modification, because something visual or imagined by means of viewing might be easier to sell. Thus, as the raw people, women, children, and people of good natural understanding, in Herder's terms, served as models of this unmediated expressiveness and a threshold and a threshold figures into an unknown world of music as expression of the self, they also served as mimetic capital. Mimetic capital is a term applied on visual fantasies of the others the European conquerors imported, and I just remind you of my a little picture of the sea maids on the maps of the conquerors. And the word capital means that these pictures were not only stored, but generated new pictures, thus accumulating the visual capital defining the world. And I think this can be applied to music as well, as indicated by the frequency of colonial metaphors in aesthetic writings since the 18th century. Like this letter, last one from Herder, which I'm just showing you and reading the English translation. The undiscovered land we are looking for is no metaphysical chatting of words. It is the innermost physics of the spirit, a fertile and useful area in the soul's doctrine of beauty, from where one will overview lots of new districts as soon as annotations and the right conclusions will have brought us to them. It is very interesting, in my opinion, that he emphasizes that he's not talking about metaphors. He is right, I think. What he's talking about is mimetic capital as it is revealed by this Colonia metaphor. Well, what to conclude from this sort of dark vision I designed? I want to leave this open for the discussion. And please apologize my using of a colonial visual metaphor at the end. I came across it when I was looking at these maps of the European conquerors. But for me, this picture shows a threshold figure sailing by herself. Thank you.